When was the last time you refreshed your bedding? Sleep cooler with Avocado's naturally breathable, certified organic sheets. Choose from GOTS-certified organic cotton, linen, or hemp, all made-safe certified to the highest standards of non-toxic safety, delivering the ultimate in luxury, sustainability, and style, and a deeper, more restorative sleep. Join Avocado's mission to be one of the world's most sustainable brands at avocadomattress.com.
Hi, I'm Devin Whitmire. People from South Carolina, like myself, are proud of their state, but even we don't know every nook and cranny or every piece of culture or history. To explore places that are off the beaten path, you have to talk to the people there, because their stories, their ideas make everything come together. From Discover South Carolina, it's the Palmetto Porch. To learn more, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.
Before we start, just want to make sure we're clear here. While this podcast talks about sobriety, mental health, and addiction, it is not meant to replace professional medical advice. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're ex-sisters-in-law, brought together in marriage and bonded through our sobriety journey.
Join us as we talk sobriety, addiction, and everything in between. You're in for quite a ride. And our Substack is buzzing with amazing content, from creative mocktail recipes to insightful courses and reflective exercises. There is something for everyone. Don't miss out. It's a great way to add some extra joy and depth to your journey. Check it out. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety. Today, we are so thrilled to welcome Sarah Allen Benton to our podcast. Sarah is a licensed mental health counselor and advanced alcohol and drug counselor with over 18 years of personal recovery from alcohol.
She is the co-owner of Benton Behavioral Health Consulting. Sarah is also the author of Understanding the High-Functioning Alcoholic, and her latest book, Parents in Recovery, offers valuable insights for parents maintaining sobriety while raising children.
So in today's episode, we'll explore the intersection of sobriety, recovery, parenting, and we'll draw from Sarah's professional and personal experience. Welcome, Sarah.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
We are so happy to have you. So can you share a little bit about your personal journey to sobriety and also what motivated you to pursue a career in mental health?
Sure. So 100 years ago, no, I'm just kidding. I've always been a very outgoing social person. And I guess along with that came drinking. I feel like the culture around drinking's changed a little bit for younger generation, but I know growing up in the early 90s and being in high school, the minute I got to high school, I drank. And I, looking back now, the first time I drank alcoholically, and I didn't know that. I thought it was normal. I thought, oh, you have 9 shots and then you black out. I don't know where that frame of reference came from. I didn't have that in my family where people drank visibly to that level. And I remember just being really focused on doing well in school and being a good student and being in every single club in the entire world. And I feel like that was the beginning of, you know, my first work was on high-functioning alcoholics. And again, I had no frame of reference. I didn't know what that profile looked like, but it was just what I was doing unintentionally. So, you know, my grades were good. I had a lot of friends, and I loved to party. So I went to college and Of course, I chose the number two party school at the time because I'm smart. And University of Colorado at Boulder, it was, you know, it really, it pulled through for me. It was everything I wanted it to be and more. So I joined a sorority, and the choices I was making throughout my life did have something to do with drinking. And I didn't see that. I didn't see that alcohol was calling the shots at a young age for me. I just thought, oh, you're young and having fun. And yes, that's true. But it became more apparent over time. So, you know, I made it. I survived college. And again, it was nothing changed about my drinking. A lot of people talk about progression. And I used to have a couple, and then I started drinking so much I blacked out. Like, for me, that was from the beginning. There was no, every time I drank, it was sort of the same story. And there was some part of me that liked it. There was some part of me, and there's a great book called Blackout by Sarah Hapola. Mm-hmm.
I love that book.
I love that book. Like, she really captured the blackout drinker's brain. That doesn't make much sense to a non-blackout drinker or just a normal person in general. But I was that person that sort of liked to escape into like a different planet and then come back down. But at the same time, I had rules. I had tons of rules for my drinking. And that was what really kept me functioning, also kept my grades good. And I'm extremely organized and disciplined in every way. For me, it's when I start to drink that there's a problem. So I can not drink, if that makes sense. But once I start, there is no shut off. So college, I move on. I successfully obtained the Pledge Class Lush Award along with academic awards. So I'd pull off these sort of seemingly hypocritical. I would get praise and laughter, and I'm a pretty good storyteller. And so I did have the best stories. I had a lot of good stories the next day. And, you know, that's great when you're in your 20s, you know, you're in college. But then I moved on to Los Angeles to pursue a career in television production. That was really my original career. And all of a sudden, I was like, you know, we're in LA, we're not in Boulder, we need to chill out. And I had a lot of friends that I partied with. I just always kind of took it to the next level. So I started to, on my 23rd birthday, I woke up after, of course, blacking out, not remembering half the night, and thinking, this is strange. Like, I thought this is the stuff you outgrow. I didn't know, like, at 23, I'd still be doing what I did at college. Like, I really thought I was just going to evolve into this normal drinker. And that wasn't happening. And that really kind of freaked me out. And I had this moment of clarity that I acted on, because I stopped drinking for 6 months. And that, of course, everyone thought, I must not have a problem. Look at her. She can stop. Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Because a lot of people were drinking, even if they were drinking more normally, they didn't stop altogether. And so I did, but I felt like crap the whole time. And I didn't know what that was about. My stomach was a mess. I had horrific anxiety. My brain was on fire. I was writing. I was, you know, a dry drunk. I didn't know what that was. So at almost 6 months in, I started to reach my goal, but then somebody came to town, so I cut it short by a week. You know, who's counting? And I was able to drink. I remember normally, I remember that first drink, my tolerance was so low. I remember, and then I was right back at it. I moved from LA to Nantucket Island, if anybody knows where that is. Not a place to move for sobriety. And that was a summer of debauchery. And then I moved to Boston, where I went and decided to go back to school and get my master's degree in counseling psychology. And that, you know, for me, I got inspired by a group I had attended there, because I had digestive issues, likely because of my drinking, and didn't know what it was, and went into this medical symptom reduction group that I just felt so inspired by the therapists and nurses that led those groups. And I thought, this is a meaningful career. And I didn't feel that meaning with television. So I felt like it was fun, but I didn't feel the same meaning. So I went back, got my master's degree. And I also thought, you know, I think you can fix yourself. Like, if you go back to school and get your master's degree, you can solve all of your issues. So I knew alcohol was an issue for me, but I just didn't think I was an alcoholic, because that was those people and not me. And look at me, I'm successful and I get great grades. And to be honest, other people reinforced that stereotype for me. When I was 27 and I had tried to control my drinking for 4 years, since the age of 23, since that birthday of revelation, I tried different ways to control my drinking, literally down to meditation before I went out, thinking it would keep me from blacking out. And that makes a lot of sense. It made a lot of sense at the time, actually.
It's amazing all the ways that we can justify it, right? Like, to say, no, we're not, we don't have problem drinking.
Yeah.
we're drinking, or
I was thinking like if I just stay in contact with my higher power, like, it was like the weirdest thing. Like yeah. It made sense to me, and I'd say it to friends, and they'd reflect back like, that sounds ridiculous. And I'm like, you just don't understand how, you know, connected I am. As I then blacked out that night.
Right.
You believed me on bullshit. And the thing is, I'm actually not a liar. Like, I'm actually a really honest person. And so, you know, I also really goal oriented. So this was that one thing that I just couldn't outthink. And that for me was humbling and scary at the same time. But the 4 years of experimentation actually really helped me gather data. And I went to even a moderation management therapist, which everybody laughs at, but I heard about it in grad school and I was like, ooh, they could fix me.
Yeah.
And they, you know, basically were like, you're probably not gonna cut it. But I was like, I can put them into anything. And I tried, and of course I failed. So, but it helped me realize along the way, if you have to control something, it's out of control. So when I was 27, it was the Super Bowl with the Janet Jackson Nipplegate and all that fun stuff. And I, you know, blacked it out on a big screen in front of me at a bar. And that was my last night. And I couldn't do it anymore. I think every time I drank was actually probably some sort of a bottom, just because I didn't know where I was. And I mean, safety wise, it was outrageous. But just what it does to you, your soul and spirit, and, you know, your body is like doing things your mind doesn't even know where it is. And it's very strange, but you don't remember it. So there's some part of you that can repress it easier. So I woke up with a hole in my soul that morning, and I just was like, I can't do this anymore. And I want to live a normal life. Like, there was a part of me that was like, you know what? I'm never gonna be able to get married, have kids, have a family, like live a normal life. Like, I can pull off the career stuff, but the other stuff's going to go. I'm not gonna be able to pull this off. So I just decided, I just had a moment, and then my friends confronted me at that time. It was one of those like perfect storms in a good way, like where I had come to the realization along with people that loved me. And it's the only time people really said anything to me. I think they were scared and whatnot. So I went and got an assessment at a local hospital, like in the addiction psychiatry unit, at the recommendation of my doctor. And I had already tried moderation, so like, you need abstinence-based, and if you can't pull this off outpatient, then you're going to need to go to rehab. And I was like, rehab? That's for real alcoholics. Like, what? So I put together a whole outpatient program for myself, like a good therapist. I had like once with therapy and a women's early recovery group and a self-help meetings, and I did yoga, and I just put together, and it sucked. I felt like crap for a couple of years, actually. I just am not one of those people that pink clouded. I just didn't feel great. And I was gray, and I was like, life's boring. And I wasn't pumped. But I knew it was what I needed to do. I wasn't doing it for the reward I was getting, because I wasn't getting much reward. It was like a long-term investment, really, in my future. That's the way I viewed it. Is that I need to take care of this now or I'm fucked. So I did it, and that was 20 years ago.
Wow.
Somehow I stuck with it. And it's been, a totally different, my gratitude is in such a different place now than it was then. And I'm so glad I did it then and not now, because I see people and parents, and trying to do this when you have children is so hard. You know, I am in the field, I am an addiction specialist. So I'm in it like, both personally and professionally. You know, the parenting piece for me, I think I learn by writing. Like, things make sense to me when I write. And my first book helped me to conceptualize and understand myself as a high functioning alcoholic, because it didn't make sense. You didn't understand how you could be doing well and also be alcoholic. Like, I just struggled to conceptualize that profile. And I was able to interview so many people and learn, and it all clicked. And then with this, parenting's not come easily to me for a variety of reasons, not just because I'm in recovery, but I think that was another layer that I hadn't fully considered until the topic for this book came along, and I started to like formulate what I wanted to do. And then it again is another one of those things that just clicked as I started to go along and write. So wow. Here I am.
So at what point in this do you open Benton Behavioral Health Consulting?
So when I first got into the field, I was doing more general therapy. And then after my first book came out, I started to specialize. I worked at McLean Hospital in a dual diagnosis program, and I moved to Connecticut. I started working in addiction treatment specific programs, but my husband and I are both in recovery, and we wanted to start doing more just consulting. But I also was doing, which I love, public speaking. I was doing a lot of continuing education events for therapists. It started with high functioning alcoholic, like really specifically working with that population, and then it's expanded into other topics of interest professionally for me. So the consulting business sort of branched out of the work I was doing on the side, but also consulting that my husband and I do for startups. And then we've since opened our own mental health treatment program that also treats clients that have dual diagnosis. So that's pretty cool. We just opened that. We just opened in July, Waterview Behavioral Health. So yeah, there's a lot of alignment with my career and my recovery, like, which is good, I think, but also can sometimes be a lot in terms of recovery saturation and like my own recovery and then like clients and topic, you know, just everything's recovery.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. How has your perspective on recovery changed in the last 2 decades?
It's changed so much. Mm-hmm. I realize that nothing good has really come for those that I've seen continue to drink into their 40s. Mm-hmm. I started to see a shift. I think I got out when I could have gotten away with it and it was still funny and fun. Well, it was sort of funny, but you know, it was, I had a few years left in me, you know what I'm saying? So I feel like now, as we get into the parenting stage of life, should you choose to have children, there's just a shift in what it does. It's just not about you anymore. Now you have a family, you have other people involved. For me, it was a very selfish activity and there weren't as many people that relied on me, or I wasn't a parent. And so my gratitude has shifted to a place where I'm like, gosh, I'm so grateful to my younger self for doing this. Mm-hmm. And I also am so grateful to not have to go through this at this age when I have this extra layer of responsibility. And it's harder to have self time. As a parent, there's barriers that make it harder to start recovery than when you're single and you're just going to work. I mean, seriously, like it's just harder. There's other layers. And that's what my book is about, how do you make it become a lifestyle in the way you live your life? Because there's a lot of people and a lot of parents and a lot of cultures around the country where the sippy cups are for Chardonnay and all that mommy culture is real. And some places it's more prevalent than others, but I think that they're, and I give props out to, you know, stay-at-home moms. I think there's a level of monotony that could drive me to drink now. I think I always thought, what's so hard about this? And then I stayed home for 4 months and wanted to poke my eyes out. But I never got it. I didn't understand till I was a parent about, like, what is it that makes it ripe for more drinking? Like, why? And so my gratitude is that I found other ways to survive parenting and to thrive, and also to create a culture in my husband and I with my daughter where we're prepping her with coping skills and ways that things that we do and boundaries we have around downtime and self-care that she just gets. That's just the way it is. That this isn't up for debate. I'm not asking your opinion. Like, this is how we operate. And she picked up on some of those things as well. She's a teenager now, so.
So as we shift to talking about parenting, do you find there's a unique stigma associated with being a parent in recovery?
Well, that was part of, I definitely tried to capture that in my interviews with other parents who, you know, I had the privilege and honor of interviewing parents with over, like together, there were over 400 years of recovery in the people that I interviewed. So that was pretty outstanding. I got a lot of wisdom, and my book wouldn't have the merit that it has without their voices. And so I learned from them and realized that we had all been sort of trudging along ourselves and not really knowing what and how we were doing this. I wanted to put together a field guide in a sense. And so one of those chapters was around this either paradox of feeling a bit hypocritical. Like, I was this irresponsible person in some ways, and now here I am in a parental role. Like, it feels, there's parts of it that feel weird. There's also that other parents and how, you know, disclosure, what do you disclose? What's your comfort level of what you disclose to other parents? Are you afraid of their opinion? Is it a recovery pride thing for me? I'm at that place where if you Google my name anyway, like, so much comes up. There's really not much that's hidden at this point. And I also find that for me, when I've been open about it with other parents, I literally the other week just got two text messages from parents who were looking for help for loved ones. I mean, my husband's had another parent come to him, you know, just around their own drinking. So for me, it's like an act of service to be able to be honest. And also, if I'm so secretive about it, I don't understand, like, why I should feel ashamed that I've been sober for 20 years. That's not coming from me. That's coming from society, right? But I mean, really, it's something I should be proud of, and I am proud of it. And so I'm not going to hide it from people. In fact, I think more people in recovery, there's 23 million of us, more people should talk about it so that other people see the success stories instead of hearing just about the epidemics and about how there's just no way out.
How does your book address the challenges parents in recovery may experience when they're raising toddlers versus teenagers?
Yeah, so I actually went through one chapter and I just went through the different developmental stages to try to capture the hard parts. I called it dog years, but for some parents, the earlier, like, parents all have their preferences about what age groups they like. Usually you'll find somebody will say, I gravitate towards this or I gravitate towards that. I think that there were challenges to both. So I feel like there's good parts to, there's an obliviousness when your kids are young, right? So for some parents, they got sober after having children. Mm-hmm. Some parents got sober before. Some had children before and then they had like a combo. They had like kids that had seen them in active use and kids that never had. So there were all these different types of parents in recovery. But the toddler stage, there was this level of dependency that's really, you know, it's hard to keep your eyes off and to have that space to try and go to your meetings or do your self-help, your self-care stuff. There was a level of sleep deprivation that could go along with some of those stages where for some people it was just catastrophic for their mental health. I actually found that sleep deprivation affects people differently. There were some people that found that to be harder than others, whereas the teenage years were scaring parents in recovery in a different way, where they were starting to face the reality of, well, substance use could be an option at this point. Whereas as a toddler, they're kind of in your control-ish. Mm-hmm. You can't control their every movement, but they're in your they're in your home. And right. I interviewed a control group of parents who were not in recovery to have a point of comparison. And I found that these parents actually worried a lot less about their children having or developing substance use disorder issues, which was funny to me. I actually thought that was a common fear amongst parents of teenagers, right? Like, but I noticed a big difference between how much it went through the minds of those in recovery. And they themselves could have been drinkers too. I'm not saying that they were all just not at all. It wasn't in their lives. It just wasn't hugely on their radar, where for us, you could read in the interviews, some people would say they analyze their kids' every behavior. Like, oh my God, they're just so obsessed. They're so compulsive. They do these behaviors. Oh my gosh, they're going to be an addict. There was this over-analysis that would go on of children's behaviors looking for, because it's so genetic, right? A lot of people came from long lines of people with substance use disorders in their families. So there was this hypervigilance around, oh my gosh, are you displaying an addictive behavior? What are we going to do about this?
I totally have this. I have a tween. And it's so interesting when you said you interviewed a control group and they weren't as worried. And I was like, what? Really? Is this just a me thing? Because I like, honestly, if my daughter's on too much screen time, I'm like, it's an addiction. She doesn't have enough coping skills.
100%. And so I also did a whole section on electronics and social media because I went through all the research in that book, Dopamine Nation, with because I thought it's so relevant. Because to be honest, the generation that we're raising is actually more at risk, or however you want to put it, for electronic addiction issues, then I think the rates of substance use have actually gone down because the kids are just antisocial and sitting in their room by themselves. But I mean, on a plus side, we were out there, you know, we were socializing. But yeah, so there's a connection also between the like dopamine priming effect that she talks about and sort of opening up these pathways, especially for kids with attention and focus issues, that it can sometimes lend itself to more, you know, impulsive behaviors such as substance use. So there was a connection there. And so I've too had been talking to my daughter, showing her the movie The Social Dilemma. And because I'm like, this is like the breeding ground. So I think it's on our radar more. And I was actually surprised as well about like they're not being so fixated on that concern.
Yeah.
It's wild.
So wait, is there some validity though to that, to looking at the screen time, like what Kathleen's saying?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it's its own issue. And then it also has this similar effect. It can open the pathways towards other, like one, there's like a cross contamination in some ways between addictive behaviors. And so kids that kind of get really used to like altering their consciousness or zoning out or checking out, can that can then transfer into something else later on. And it can open up those like those dopamine pathways where they're craving more like hits. And that can come in different forms. And it could just stay with the phone. It could just stay with video games. I'm not a psychic, but at the same time, it can also transfer over into substance. But again, I think it's on our minds more, but I don't think it's a bad thing to be mindful for our children. I love the term digital hygiene. I love the idea of teaching our children about that. I mean, my daughter spent too much time on an iPad one time during the pandemic, and she literally looked like she was going through like withdrawal and I need to send her to detox. Like she was flipping out and crying. And I was like, what in the hell is wrong with you? And she even noticed it. She was like, what is going on? It was crazy. And she saw and felt it. I even include her journal entry about her feeling around where she felt like she overdid it and that she felt quote unquote addicted. She used the words, and she didn't like it. She didn't like that it took, she wrote down, I want to feel life, not this fake whatever. She had the awareness. She was like 11 when she wrote it, I think.
Wow. So for kids that don't necessarily have that awareness, what are some communication strategies that parents can use to talk to them about all of it?
Well, I've always found it interesting that we're fine in our society talking about genetic medical issues. You know, you have diabetes in your family or cancer in your family. It's just like, oh, well, this is something we're going to talk about, or maybe whatever, there's preventative stuff. It's just like, well, obviously I'm going to talk to you about it. But then when it comes to the mental health stuff or the addictive pieces, parents sometimes either avoid or don't quite know what to do. And so, I mean, I think there's some helpful material out there. I actually had my daughter watch just the first half of the movie, The Social Dilemma. I thought it was really age appropriate at the time. And because also, how annoying are we? You know what I mean? Like, when you constantly keep hearing it from your parent, I also want there to be other sources of this, not just myself. I even have a babysitter that has talked about how she started too young because she was at the generation where they didn't know that there was any effects. And she just talked to my daughter about it. So I think also, does it always have to come from us? I guess that's one question I have. Is there some, you know, teenager that in your life or somebody that could have a like mature conversation with your kid that they might be more receptive to than you? So I think that's one idea. But the other is talking about it from the perspective of brain chemistry and of family history and of, we want to set you guys up for success, right? And we want you to have the ability to have focus for longer than 2 minutes. We want you to be able to make it through like reading a book. And that what I said to my daughter is that this is so stimulating and so entertaining that when you go to do other things, they can feel boring. And I don't want you to feel bored by other things. And she started to see that before and after effect. I also think there's different types of use of electronics that are more stimulating than others. So having a FaceTime conversation with a friend and talking on the phone, And that's socializing for this generation. Mm-hmm. I don't find the same level of harm than sitting there and scrolling TikTok, right? So I think there's different, or video games. So I think there's different levels of stimulation. I mean, I was on my phone all the time when I was, you know, a tween and a teen. My daughter's an only child, right? So this is her lifeline to her friends.
Yeah.
So I think some of it is also, you can, there are parental controls now too on the phones where you can see, and you can control what apps they have. You can control the screen time. You can see where the time was spent. You can use it as a reward. You can use it as a punishment. I mean, I think there's a lot of ways to work around it, but some of it is about letting them have their own experience and feeling, you know, asking them to be honest with you. You're not going to take it away just from their response, but like that you want to have them have their own experience and talk to you about it. So the dialogue is important. Because when it comes to substances, kids don't want to be talking too much about it. So if they feel like you're open and it's not a punitive model, they can sometimes be more honest with you.
So what are some ways that parents who are in recovery can talk about their own sobriety with children?
Do you remember when I talked about True Diagnostics' True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I found out I was actually 39 years old biologically, while I'm 46 chronologically. But what was really eye-opening were the areas where I was on the borderline, like my blood sugar and cholesterol, and True Diagnostic gave natural recommendations to lower both of those. It matters because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 50%. But the good news is, almost 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and your environment. The True Age Test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging. And that was also eye-opening. I discovered that my brain is biologically younger, but my lungs need improvement. So I started doing some type of cardio daily. And honestly, I feel so much better knowing how my systems are aging so I can do something about it. The test itself was so easy and convenient. I did it from home. There was no doctor, no needle, just a quick, painless finger prick. So you send off that tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. It's fast and hassle-free. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to True Diagnostic and use my code CIS2025 to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use CIS2025 at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
When was the last time you refreshed your bedding? Sleep cooler with Avocado's naturally breathable, certified organic sheets. Choose from GOTS certified organic cotton, linen, or hemp. All made safe certified to the highest standards of non-toxic safety, delivering the ultimate in luxury, sustainability, and style. And a deeper, more restorative sleep. Join Avocado's mission to be one of the world's most sustainable brands at avocadomattress.com.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Yeah, that was an interesting one too. I asked every parent in recovery, like, when did you tell, you know, the telling? And I actually, I got the idea for my book from a book called Mother Noise by Cindy House.
Oh, yeah.
I was in the Merkle bookstore in Connecticut, and the name stood out to me, and I read the inside cover, and she was talking about how her son was 11 or so, and she was just really avoiding the telling, she called it, the telling, and that he knew me a certain way, and would he think of me differently, and does he really know me? Like, who I really am, because this whole part of my life I've never shared. And she also had a book coming out. So there were just pieces of it. It was very interesting. And it prompted me to think, is there a book about this? And then I started looking and I'm like, there isn't like anything out there, nonfiction. Hers is a memoir. So I was like, oh my gosh, I was blessed to be able to interview her. And I've been in touch with her. It was really cool. But that idea of the telling. So the telling for some parents is right away. They're like bringing them to self-help meetings because they don't have childcare. After the pandemic, there was a lot more access to virtual meetings, but that was never a thing. So like back when I got sober, you either were at a meeting in person or you weren't at a meeting. There was no, let's just put the phone on mute and turn off the video and listen. That was not happening. So there were a lot of parents that brought their kids to meetings when they were younger. There are other parents that, you know, just never not told them. They just, their kids probably didn't understand what they were talking about, right?
Yeah.
They just knew the language. But, and then there are some that will not share it until they're a teenager, until that actual issue of substance is a possibility in their life. I wanted to wait personally until my daughter had a conception of what addiction was. And that's why when she wrote that letter about the electronics or that journal entry, I realized she gets the concept and I'm writing a book. So this is happening. And so I had a conversation. It was funny is my husband and I work in addiction treatment and we are constantly talking about it, right? We're constantly talking about people. This one's sober. That one's not. This one relapsed. This blah, blah. So I thought she knew, like on some level, I was probably like, I'm probably being naive. So I sat there when I told her why we don't drink, because she knows we don't drink. She just thought health reasons. She was floored. She was shocked out of her mind. I was shocked at her shock because I was like, you figured this out, right? Like, it's like, couldn't have been new information. Not a clue, because I don't think she could see. She'd never seen it because we've both been sober the whole time as parents, but she couldn't picture it. And it scared her to think of us because she knows other parents that do drink and she doesn't like the personality change. She doesn't like being around people that are drinking. And so she has made comments like, if one of you relapses, like I'm gonna find somewhere else to live. She takes it seriously, whereas I would, because I didn't think she'd think it's that big of a deal because she sees other people drink, right? And it's not always a catastrophe. But I didn't think she'd take it so seriously, but she does.
You gave a good example, like when your daughter is like around other people around drinking, and so it like reminded her to say, you know, if you guys ever relapse. But how do parents handle situations where their child is exposed to substance use in social situations?
For example, my daughter. So it's interesting. We don't have many people in our lives that we don't have really anyone that comes to our house and drinks at our house. We don't have alcohol in our house. Alcohol free. So whenever we have a social event or anything, there's nobody drinking. Like we'll have a giant party and nobody's drinking. So our house is, I can't say an example, but yes, she has spent time. There's been social events where other parents were drinking. What's interesting to me, it's not that often, but when it did happen, the parents got at one particular event, got a little carried away, and other kids were coming up to her going, crying about how drunk their parents were and saying, and they said, you're so lucky your parents don't drink. And I was like,
wow,
we're not the social lepers. Like, you know, there's just certain moments where I've been caught off guard by this whole thing because I didn't think that kids would notice if their parents are like regular drinkers. I would think they're just used to that, you know, but kids are very perceptive and they pick up on energies and things. And so that was surprising. I think it depends on who it is. I think it depends on if they have a complete personality change. She really doesn't like going. There was a particular family member she wouldn't want to be around because of their personality when they drank, or they just, I don't know. She just had an aversion to it. We don't want to have her in a bubble. So she does definitely have exposure to some of it in within reason. But she does, I think, still have an appreciation for our recovery. She also sees and has friends who have parents who drink. And it's just an interesting dynamic with us being the total opposite. I
struggle with this too, Sarah, like in terms of the bubble piece, because, you know, I don't drink at home and my daughter isn't really exposed to very many people that drink at all. And one of the things I noticed is when my partner has a really big extended family, and if we go to holiday events, there's like a lot of drinking. And I've noticed for her anxiety gets worse in those situations. And I think it's that feeling of like, there's that feeling, right? Like when people are all drinking, that it's a bit out of control, like that it's, you can sense that people aren't fully in control anymore. And so I don't love going to those events. I feel not great. And, but at the same time, I also feel like one day she's going to be exposed, like she'll go to university or, you know, she'll be exposed to drinking. And so I want her to have some exposure to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a fine line. It's so funny because I think back and like, I was so oblivious. Like I see it through her eyes, but I back through my own as a kid, like I don't remember. I remember being excited at a social event, not a family one as much because it's family. To me, that was like a waste of drinking. But with friends and stuff, I like loved that chaos, you know? And you know, there is that book, The Anxious Generation. And I think it's interesting.
I just read it.
I don't know. I might do the audiobook, but I reference it. Just the name sums up so much.
Yes. Yes.
What's it about?
It's this generation is just so they're like living in a, I think I don't, it's a combination of probably I'm speculating the pandemic, the electronic use, the social, they're a little more
social media.
So they're also getting exposed to a lot of information that we didn't have as kids, but then we were like out there in the middle of, at least I was out in the middle of why I grew up in a pretty wild city. So I was exposed to all kinds of stuff like in person that was like not safe and not good. It wasn't just me like seeing it on TikTok or, you know, Instagram. So, but they, it's very interesting. I want to actually delve into that a little bit more, but I see it through their eyes. But then I think back to how oblivious I was to a party. I was just like, cool. Like, I don't know. I have a certain immunity. My daughter is different than me, you know? Like we talk about that. They're more risk averse, this generation.
Yeah. I agree with that. Yeah.
And I'm not like upset about that. I don't want them to all be like balls of anxiety disorders. But at the same time, I think there's a part of us from a generation that maybe had too much like carefreeness and just so much like nothing's going to hurt us and invincibility that we're a little bit comforted by the fact that she has common sense. But
yeah. Yeah, for sure. I agree. Absolutely. And The Anxious Generation is a great book. I highly recommend it. It did instill some fear and despair in me, I will say, but it is.
Ironically.
I know.
The Anxious Generation.
I know. I was anxious while reading it. but no, I think there's good practical things you can do in there.
Speaking of, Sarah, I don't know what this generation does for self-care, but what strategies do you recommend for parents in recovery to maintain self-care while also balancing their parenting responsibilities? I don't have kids, but I imagine you can't just like leave them and go to a spa for a day. So what are some things you can do?
Well, this was, you know, this was part of the layer that I was referencing with parenting and recovery, that for those of us that got sober prior to becoming parents, it was a bit about us. You know, our drinking's about us, our recovery's about us. It's just about us. So when you throw children into the mix in parenting, it adds a layer of having to think about something else before you check out or before you do what you do. And I also think there's a difference between self-care and what I like to call soul care, where some people can go like, yes, like getting a manicure, that's cool. Or, you know, going to a spa, that's cool. But there's a level of recovery, self-care and soul care that's going to a meeting, going to therapy, spiritual practice, being in nature, whatever floats your boat, but like this deeper connection and maintenance of emotional sobriety that is really, really hard as a parent at certain ages, particularly when that's your hard age. Like for me, young kids are the hard age. Like for me, the tweens and teens are not. And so I was like going out of my mind, yet having less time, right? To your point, like less space. So one of it is having a partner that can support you in, and if you're both in recovery, like tag team, like, okay, it's your turn. Go hit your meeting, go do your thing, go have a day to chill. I'll take over. Like having a partner that gets your recovery is really important. I actually think it's imperative. I don't really know how somebody could be either dating or married to somebody that doesn't respect or understand your recovery. I don't think it's going to end well, quite frankly. So that's part of it, is having, also asking for help from friends, from family, just because people get so, it does take a village and we're not like that anymore. And so the other thing that people would talk about, and I loved getting tips from other parents, was have another sober parent come over, let the kids play, and then have your like adult recovery chat time. So there were just these little like tips. I heard this term habit stacking too, where you do two things at once. Yeah. Like I used to go for a run with my daughter in the jogging stroller, and I would get my exercise in while she slept. There were just, you got to get creative, and it's not an optional thing. And my chapter self-care is not optional. This isn't like, oh, I'm doing this because I just feel like this is what I want to do today and I'm selfish. This is, if I don't do these things, it will catch up to me and I could relapse. And so the other thing that was interesting with the control group was they perceived self-care as something that it wasn't life or death. For people in recovery, this self-care, soul care, recovery prioritization is, it could end tragically, right? So this is where the difference between the two, in my mind, lie. And so it is important to find 5 minutes if you need to find 5 minutes. It's important to find, and to, again, can your child watch something, I don't know what the heck kids watch anymore, but the little ones, remember Baby Einstein and all that stuff? Like, can they put on something, and can you put on a recovery podcast? How can you like figure out tricks? And I think, to be honest, it's actually gotten easier post-pandemic. It's easier to work out from home. It's easier to listen to do meetings. It's easier to do yoga and mindfulness and meditation. And it doesn't mean you don't get out and socialize, but I think it was much harder back before the pandemic, when everything was in person, and like, you can't just leave your kid, and you also can't bring your kid to everything, like, or nor do you want to. I brought my daughter to one meeting and never did I do it again. I couldn't relax. I couldn't listen. I was so concerned if she was going to cry. Nobody cared, but I did. And I couldn't be present. That didn't work for me. So yeah, there were a million suggestions that were so awesome. And that's part of why I have at the end of every chapter is parent recovery wisdom. And I loved getting suggestions from other people, because I'm so sick of my own, you know. It was wonderful to get suggestions like just that I'd never thought of, and how to make it work. And it's different at different stages, you know, when your kids are in different stages. But it is, it's hard. It's harder, but it's possible. And I think the point is that many of the parents I had interviewed had successfully been able to do it. Some had relapses, but then got back on, right? It's okay. You can recommit at any time. This isn't about perfection.
Yeah, I get it. So Sarah, what do you think for single parents? Did you get any other advice that was a little bit different when you don't have a partner to kind of hand off to?
I was really, really grateful to have some interviews that were different family structures. And yeah, I found that one of the best pieces of advice that I got from the single parenting was that it's up to that parent to decide what they can and cannot fit in their lives, mm-hmm. not based on societal expectations, but based on what their bandwidth allows. And so in the case of, you know, one of these individuals that I interviewed, she, between work and raising her son, she found that dating was just not in the cards for her. Mm-hmm. And other people may have thought, you know, oh, but you need this for yourself and you and this. And she felt that this is not a priority for me. I need to keep my head up this other way. I don't have the emotional energy for that. And right now isn't the time. When he's maybe a little older, I can go there. Another parent, actually, that was a similar one too, newly divorced, sober, dating wasn't a priority, focusing on kids, work, recovery. And so I think that everyone has to figure out their own boundaries and parameters and priorities based on their, not other people's, their. And that's the compare. That's the part that's hard. Like we need to really focus on what we need. If you read my book and see the different pathways, you can see that there is no right or wrong way, mm-hmm. but you have to get honest with your limits. And that's what I've had to do through the years is my nervous system is different than my husband's. He can handle going to soccer tournaments for the whole weekend and then going back and being fine mm-hmm. on Monday. I can't do it. Mm-hmm. I literally, my nervous system will not allow for that. I can go to a game on the weekend and or two, but going away for an entire weekend and then coming back on Monday and thinking I'm going to be with my head on straight, it doesn't work for me. Mm-hmm. So he does that. And again, other people may say, oh my God, you're not going to show up for you. No, I'm not actually. And my daughter understands that that doesn't work for me. And I don't feel parent guilt. So mm-hmm. I own it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think like what you said too about it takes a village, like I'm a single parent. So I didn't have a partner to rely on when I needed self-care. But I have friends and I have Sonia. And so I would rely on that village in order to do certain things for myself, especially when my daughter was young. She's older now, so it is easier.
It is. Mm-hmm. And the other part of it is I'm an addiction therapist, right? I don't see clients directly as much at all. I'm more in the ownership phase and out of direct care because for me that is more actually more of a burnout and more draining for me in all transparency. But I used to say to clients, like, I can't be, like, you need to get your own village and your own community. Mm-hmm. I can be your higher power. I can't keep you sober. And so the same is for you, right? Where if you need to go out and get your village and go out and get your sober supports, and those individuals get it more than anybody else. And that's why I really encourage people to get involved in self-help meetings. I can list off 10 different right now, 10 different types of self-help meetings that are out there that are accessible to people, but you meet people through that. And, you know, they're, and if you're in the local area, right, there's people that want to support you. And especially like, they're not young forever, and getting those, you know, connections and asking. I think part of the problem too is people are just so afraid to burden people.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, for sure.
The people pleasing, the I don't want to burden will get you drunk. Seriously, mm-hmm. it doesn't work because you're not being honest. You're not getting your needs met. I mean, one thing I did was also I'm comfortable with babysitters. Like I had to set up when he was young. I needed to go out, you know, obviously I need to go out like once a week or something, or I needed to have that, like my brain just needed to like exhale. And that was important. I don't find it as important as she's gotten older because she can go in one part of the house and like we have space. And I'm a person that needs a little space and it's okay. Like she does too. And she respects it. We're both only children.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm an only child and so is my daughter. So I get that.
Isn't it funny? And then my husband, like, oh my God, this is two only children, because the things we say are two only children.
Yeah, we definitely have that. How can parents in recovery navigate changes in their marriages or partnerships due to sobriety? That's like a whole other episode.
I think it's a good question for Kathleen too, because she's a couples therapist. So I thought you guys could both answer that question.
Gosh, bless you for your work. Outnumbered. That's what they should call it.
Yeah.
I love it. I do. I love it. But
that's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I've had to, being an addiction therapist, I can't avoid family systems.
No.
Right. So I became a default family therapist. So that's a great question. And it was very real. I also think the transition into sobriety for a lot of people was a reality check around what they could and could not have relationship-wise in their lives. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of seismic shifts that went on for some individuals, and it didn't have to happen the minute they got sober, but you start to realize so much about yourself and who you really are when you get sober. And if you've been in a partnership that hasn't been working, and it's really hard when you're sober to continue on in that way authentically, because you have no, like, your numbing agent is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so the things that alcohol allows for us to have in our lives, or substances allow for us to have in our lives, when you pull that away, the glue is gone and things can fall apart. So, and the other part of it is, well, first of all, being more mindful in choices, right, around who you are bringing into your life. And also, can people do it in a non-addictive manner, right? Mm-hmm. Like, can you bring someone in your life romantically, where it's not like all or nothing, where there is some moderation, because there are substitutions that happen for people, and people that are prone to relationship, to kind of codependent type dynamics, they can put down the bottle or put down the pills and then just glom on to another human. And it's real. I mean, it happens with food, it happens with gambling, it happens with sex. Like, this is real. It happens with phones. It happens with shopping. And so I think the real work is figuring out, how much time do you need in recovery before you can enter into something in a healthy way without an addictive motor behind it? When do you not need but want something? When is it the icing on the cake but not the cake? So I think those are the questions for people to really get honest with themselves about, when especially another child's involved, when there's children involved and you're subjecting them to, you know, flavor of the week. I think that, you know, there's different family structures happened because of divorce. So then there were, you know, navigating other families, right? Because then now we have, and it can turn into a blessing. It doesn't all have to be, it can be more love, right? It doesn't have to be more discord. But those are all things to navigate. And I think having sober ears to bounce thoughts and ideas and have a couples therapist that understands recovery, I always recommend everybody that is getting therapy to go to an addiction specialist, because there's so much to recovery that an average therapist doesn't learn. I didn't learn shit in grad school, just so everybody knows. Like, I didn't learn one thing about addiction therapy in grad school. I learned this is what cocaine does. And this is what alcohol does. Nothing about treatment. Nothing, literally, which is sad. I learned everything on the job and in my own recovery and through training. Like, I've gotten my own continuing ed trainings and things like that. I am an advanced alcohol and drug counselor at this point, but I didn't go to school for it. I was all grandfathered in from all of my experience. So I think that you need to have the right people in your court to, like, help navigate these things and not to try to do it yourself.
I find, like, in my practice, when I see couples who are parents, who one person is in recovery and let's say it's new recovery, you know, it leads to a whole different dynamic. And so it's a very intense journey for both people in the couple, right?
It's so hard. There's actually a great book called Love Without Martinis.
Interesting.
By, her last name is Jovan. I actually interviewed her for blog, Iowa Psychology Today blog. And I think that when one partner gets sober and the other doesn't, either because they have a problem or they're just have a normal relationship to substances, which actually is the story with a couple of the people I interviewed in my book. Not everybody was married to somebody in recovery.
Mm. Yeah.
But there was a healthy respect for their recovery, if that makes sense.
Right. Exactly.
Like, you don't have to be sober, but you have to respect your spouse's recovery. Like, I'm
100%.
I'm not going to, like, bend on them. Like, I'm not going to be like, there's no but. Like, that's just the requirement.
It's the bare minimum.
I've been dating, like, over the last, like, I don't know, year. Like, I realized it's a requirement for me that someone really celebrates, like, my recovery and not just, like, puts up with it.
Totally. And again, there were other people interviewed too that were single and dating and there. And one of them was saying, you know, I can date somebody that uses substances. Just not addictively, or, you know, like, everyone had their boundaries, but that person has to respect the other person's choices. And so the unbelievable, like, shift in a relationship when one person gets sober and the other isn't in recovery for whatever reason. And maybe they just, rarely is it that they're indifferent and just stop, but sometimes that can happen, and that's easier to maneuver in some ways. But there's so much that goes on. If you yourself as a therapist don't understand that dynamic, one of the things that can happen is, oh, it was all about your substance use and drinking, and now it's all about your recovery. What about me? Mm-hmm. Why is there no time for me? Why all these meetings? Who are these people that you are, like, telling all these things to? You trust them more than you trust me, and there can be competition with the recovery, with their sober peers. It's the stuff that can go on that if you don't understand as a therapist, the dynamics are what's normal, what's not, what's to be expected, and helping them to prepare for this journey, it can be really hard. And so that's kind of what Love Without Martinis, that book, is about the experience of the spouse that didn't get sober, because nobody talks about that. You know, they have their own journey.
When that person, their spouse, was drinking or using a substance, like, all the hurt that was caused, like, that's a hard thing to face, right? Mm-hmm. It's a hard thing to voice and face and then be able to move forward.
And also support their new recovery.
Yeah. Yep.
Pissed off.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, this is also why they need their own beyond therapy. I mean, this is why there's Al-Anon. This is why there's
Absolutely. Ar-Anon. Absolutely.
This is why there's Learn to Cope and Move to Heal and CARES. Like, families, and ideally family members and loved ones, should have a parallel recovery process. Mm. They were in a relationship with somebody with an active addiction, and they need healing too. They have their own recovery process of even why they stayed. I mean, they have to work through all of this.
You know, thank you so much, Sarah. I think we've both, you know, really engaged in this conversation, all of us, and learned so much from you today. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. You both are wonderful, and I really loved chatting with you.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to Sisters in Sobriety, and we will see you next week.
This was Sisters in Sobriety.
Thank you for listening and being with us today.
If you want to learn more about sobriety and meet your community, find us at sistersinsobriety.substack.com.
Are you a sister in sobriety? Then reach out on social media. We'd love to hear from you.
If you're feeling generous, leave us 5 stars and a review and follow us wherever you listen.
You'll never miss an episode. Until next time.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It
prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.